and you go down to a place like P3, and you've got the one athlete from each team who wants to train. And you think that's what the NBA is like, right? Man, these guys just want to get after it, and they're super explosive, and this and that and the other. Well, we forget that athletes aren't exercise science students. They're not nutrition majors. They like playing basketball. And all the other stuff is actually really hard for them.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Basketball Strong Podcast. I'm Tim DeFrancesco, former LA Lakers strength and conditioning coach and doctor of physical therapy, and I'm here with my co-host, Emmy-nominated writer and author, Phil White. This podcast is not just for basketball junkies. It's for anyone who loves to hear the human stories behind great people while learning the science behind preparing your body for the court and high performance. Today's guest is Dr. Jeremy Bettel. Jeremy has a PhD in human performance, and he has held strength and conditioning, sports science, and director of performance positions in the NBA, in Major League Soccer, in the NHL, in pro rugby, and elite level Division I college environments. You can follow Jeremy on Instagram at Jeremy Bettel Coaching. That's at JeremyBettele Coaching, as well as JeremyBettel.com. Jeremy and I came into the NBA about the same time, and he has had such an incredible journey since his NBA days. It was so fascinating to listen to him tell about the steps that he took, how he took them, why he took them. He tells some great Kevin Garnett stories, and he gets into his take on load management, wearable sleep devices, and athlete monitoring, and much, much more. Let's get into the conversation.
So, Jez, we're curious, looking at your background and a very lengthy LinkedIn page. You're very distinguished, my friend. How on earth does one go from merry old England, where we grew up, to college in Tennessee?
Yeah, it was an interesting leap. So my dad, actually, he moved over to the States when I was young, ended up settling in Tennessee. And so when I had finished my undergrad, I was working in private fitness club back in the UK, thinking, man, there's got to be more to this industry than this. And so he said, well, why don't you come over to the States and do a master's? And Middle Tennessee State was sort of the nearest college to him. And they had a master's and a PhD program in exercise science, and that was that.
Wow. So, was that a... when you went from a fitness setting into that master's sort of academia version of things, is this what kind of wet your whistle for what could be more and the research side of what you then built your career off of?
Yeah, 100%. You know, it was really interesting because I played rugby growing up and it didn't turn professional until 1995. So all those support structures, there weren't strength coaches, there weren't like strength conditioning, sports science. It wasn't really an industry when I was doing my undergrad. So I knew I wanted to be involved in sport, but there just wasn't opportunity. So you were starting to see those first strength coaches that were coming over from Australia, largely out of that AIS system and rugby. Yep. While it globally wasn't professional until 95, it had been pretty professional in Australia before that, you know, under the table. So they sure. They sort of had some of those practices in place already. And so you started seeing the first full-time strength coaches coming over. But then coming over to the States and seeing it as it's an industry, right? You Middle Tennessee State is not a large college, but just an amazing strength conditioning facility, you know, multiple strength coaches, you know. And so that's when I started saying, oh, okay, wow, like, you can have a job doing this. Like, that'd be really cool. So, you know, going through the masters and staying involved on the practical side, and then even into the PhD, I knew I didn't want to be in academia.
Got it.
I always wanted to be on that practical side, but I knew if I wanted to get to the top where I aspired to be, having the PhD was always going to be helpful.
Got it. So you went, connect the dots from Middle Tennessee to where you went from there. Cause somewhere was that what was the connection there from or the conduit from Middle Tennessee all the way to becoming the sports performance director at UCSB?
Yeah, so really interesting sequence of events. I actually reached out during grad school to USA Rugby. Wanted to do my research with them, you know, grew up playing rugby. So that was sort of the dream, actually, was to finish my master's in a year and go back and work in rugby. That was 20 years ago now. So
right. It's just a dream. It's a dream. Well. It's a dream deferred. That's all right. Not
yeah,
right.
Exactly. Exactly. So managed to get in touch with them at USA Rugby, and it was great timing because they were just transitioning to a new high performance model. And so was able to come in and do some research with them. And I was sort of running the video for them and doing all that side of things, and met the physical therapist with the team as we were building up to the World Cup. Was Maury Hayashida, who he owns a series of clinics out here in Santa Barbara, physical therapy clinics. And so he was saying, well, you know, you should come and check out what we're doing in Santa Barbara. And so that was a very short conversation with my wife.
Right. It's pretty rough out there, Jez. We're a bit worried about you, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it is slightly foggy today, so we're a little bit under the weather today. So everyone's a bit gloomy.
Tough.
Yeah, rough day. It should break by about 10 with any luck, so we'll be okay. Yeah.
By the time you make it to the water.
Yeah, exactly. So, we moved out, and, you know, it was a gap in my skill set. At the time, the sort of rehab piece, that transitional piece between an athlete being injured and an athlete being healthy, you know, it's like, well, what happens in between when they get cleared by the physio, but they're not quite there? And so I really needed to up my game in that sense. So came out and worked in private practice PT with Maury for a couple of years, where we were building those programs of, okay, this guy had surgery yesterday. What can we do with him today? And really systematically building that program so that when guys were cleared to play, they were really ready. You know, it wasn't just that, okay, cleared and now get them in shape.
Oh, well, yeah. So that's kind of the space that Sue Falzone tried to explore, you know, in the book Bridging the Gap. And that's what she was saying, like bridging the gap, meaning exactly what you said, continuum of care. From the moment of acute injury to not just cleared to return to practice or play, but actually coming back full strength. And so, yeah, that's interesting that you were humble enough to say, well, okay, I'm pretty good at this and this already, but this is a glaring gap and I need to fill it. Mm-hmm. And then it sounds like Maury and team were, you know, were good to help. Talk about a little bit about his mentorship and that relationship in that setting.
Yeah, he's been and continues to be an unbelievable mentor for me. You know, I'm back working with Maury now and continuing to learn more on that side. He's one of the best physical therapists that I've worked with directly, you know, in that, first of all, he sees that full picture. A lot of times, you know, we can be very good clinicians, but don't see the physical therapy role extending all the way up into and after they've been cleared to play. You know, I think it's a spectrum. It's not a sort of siloed category. Okay, now you're onto strength conditioning and now you're onto the coaches. So we share a vision in that sense. And so his ability to dial up the ladder and back down, you know, has been key to my learning and how I can regress an athlete. Because, you know, you guys will know that most of your athletes are injured basically all of the time, you know, in some regard. Everybody's got something that's sore. So as a strength coach, you design this perfect workout and then nobody can do it, you know, because everyone's got a little something. And so how do you dial that workout back? You know, and that's where Maury's mentorship really came in on, okay, they can't bench today. What can they do? Right. Maybe we've got to move that to this exercise. We can still do the pattern, but we got to find a way that it works for that athlete and what they're dealing with.
Right. And that's, some of that is time. Some of it is mentorship from somebody who's been there, done that. And you start to build your toolbox from seeing it. Some of it is a feel too. I mean, I think you just have to, there is a feel aspect. And then there's the scientific aspect of what you're monitoring to be able to make those choices. And we'll get into that later. I am curious in the, when you recognized that gap in your skill set, when you recognized it, sometimes I see where that could be a pretty kind of in your face moment where it's not always pretty. I know for me, I can think back to a couple of athletes who I was in charge of, and that skill set, part of my skill set, hadn't quite developed to what it is today, and it just didn't go as planned. And then it's sort of like, okay, look in the mirror and figure out, okay, there's a gap here, and I have to face it and I have to fill it. Were there any moments like that for you where you can think of that it was sort of like, this is telling me real kind of aggressively and in my face that this is something I need to get better at?
Yeah, no question. I mean, we were actually lifting with the boys at the Rugby World Cup, right? And so pretty high stakes, you know, everything you do at the tournament, right? You can't disrupt what's going to happen in the game.
Whereabouts and was so, this, mate? Which World Cup?
That was France 2007.
Nice.
Yeah. So we had a tough schedule. We had games, opening game, and then 4 days later, second game. Then we had a 2 week gap, and then the same again, two games in 4 days. And so, you know, it's really tough to manage that middle stretch when you're away for a month. And so we're doing our lifts, and it was one of those moments, Tim, where you've designed the lift, as I said, you know, it's on the board and you've got one of your key guys and you just can't do it.
Yeah.
And it's that moment where you're sort of stuck and you don't really know what to do.
Yeah.
And I hate that default of, oh, you can't bench because your shoulder's sore. Go ride the bike, right?
Right, right.
Let's just avoid upper body. Let's shut him. Let you know. Don't do anything. And that was one of those moments for me. You know, I didn't have anything else to give him, and so you know that's where I think it really, really smacked me, because this is a real high stakes moment with high level athletes, and you feel like you're almost letting them down because you don't have the toolkit you need to be at that level.
Right. No, that's. And that's often what it takes to kind of say like, okay, I'm gonna make a weakness a strength. I'm also curious in the sort of spectrum that you talked about as an athlete does go from injured to return to play, and how that has to be a little bit of a sliding scale and is never just a perfectly linear process. You certainly have a great feel for that, and you took a certain amount of mentorship along the way of how to do that, but where do you feel like some of the common mistakes are made, or what pitfalls are within that process that you've either seen or that you now kind of have built a system around making sure to avoid?
I think it's just the gaps, you know, the handoffs that happen, you know, from physician, athletic trainer, physical therapist. It's often a sort of arbitrary timeline.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, 6 months after ACL or however many months after ACL, okay, you're cleared to run. And we're clearing people to run before we're clearing them to do plyometrics.
Right.
Forgetting that running is 8 to 10 times body weight, single leg plyometrics. And we wonder why we bring a guy back and then they flare up and we got to regress them, and we bring them back and they regress them. So we've got this stepwise approach where the demands suddenly spike. We suddenly clear them for something. So the athlete's excited and goes and does it. And then a week later, they're flared up and they're set back. So I think certainly within that medical component, the actual acute rehab, keeping an eye on what demands are we preparing them for next? Not even the game, but what are they going to be cleared for next? Non-weight bearing to weight bearing, right? Weight bearing to running, you know, these sorts of steps, and making sure that we're conscious of those demand increases and that we gradually improve and towards that, you know, throughout that phase of rehab. So it becomes a little bit more linear and less of a big step. And then,
keep going.
Then it's sort of just handed off, right? You know, okay, 6 months, boom. Number one, when your physician goes and tells the GM at 6 months, okay, he's cleared.
Right.
And you're like, oh God.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And the strength coach is on the clock. Right.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean he can't go? He's cleared.
Right.
Doc said, right.
Doc said.
Yeah. So I think, you know, first of all, a team approach that's medical clearance, right? If it's an ACL, the graft is healed.
Yeah.
But that doesn't account for any of the mechanics that have created the issue in the first place, maybe left you susceptible to your ACL injury. But also that you've had like 6 months of detraining there. So now you're susceptible to Achilles, to groin, to hamstring injuries. How are you checking off these other injury risk factors before you return them to play? And so just like we did a step-by-step approach on what are the next demands, now we start, okay, what are the demands of practice? What are the demands of the game? And we've got to keep them going through that so that that clear to play is just the next intuitive step. And it doesn't feel like this big thing where the guy's now got to take time getting in shape.
That's such a good point, because I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but it does happen so often where it's any point in that process and the person that is shepherding it or guiding it and overseeing it from the exercise and therapy prescription side of it are often thinking the final step is what I'm preparing this person for. And yeah. What you're saying is there's like five steps before we get to that are not being thought of as steps of clearance. And that is a huge, that's such a good point. So how does this then turn into you becoming the sports performance director at UCSB?
You know what, mate, again, it's the timing, and this has shown up throughout my career, you know, timing was great. I'd connected with Marcus Elliott here in town, you know, down at P3 as well.
Yeah.
Which is weird that there's such a cluster of great performance practitioners when there's basically no sport here. So
right.
It's just this really cool little town that people want to come to. So, so I've been chatting with Marcus. He let me know that, the job was coming available up there at UCSB. They were in their interview process, and you know, he knew the assistant AD up there, Diane O'Brien. And so, you know, she gave me an interview, and I got in for the day. And it was about that time when I felt like I'd got far enough in my learning curve with the rehab piece that I now needed to go and apply it and get back into the strength conditioning world.
Got it.
And that timing was just amazing that it just opened up at that time, and was super fortunate to get that role as you know, a pretty risky hire for them. You know, I hadn't been in a traditional US strength conditioning setting. You know, this weird Brit who's never really worked in basketball, right?
Bit so, dodgy, mate, frankly.
Yeah. Look, yeah. Well, that was what she used. Yeah. So yeah, it was really interesting. Like, to be able to go into that new environment, bring a completely fresh set of ideas and a fresh look at the problem, you know, because I was such an outside the box hire.
Amazing. So be honest, were you thinking at this point, okay, this is a step in the ladder towards an NBA or a pro team sports setting in the US, or where was your mindset career wise at this point?
You know, I knew I wanted to get to the top, but yeah. it wasn't that I was sort of deliberately thinking, okay, next step is going to be the NBA. You know, I had always thought if I take care of everything I can control, I get as good as I can be, then I'll get a shot at what's good. Next.
Good things will happen. Right? Yep.
Yeah. You know, yes, there's only 30 NBA jobs, but they're going to hire someone.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a PhD and experience and you've done all these things, then you stand a good chance. So I don't think I thought I was, you know, relatively surprised to get that job, you know, because it was there was some really good strength coaches in the running, I think, you know, from the collegiate setting. So I think I was just fortunate to get the job and absolutely terrified to actually have to execute it now.
So how did
right?
You,
we'll
how
talk
did,
about yeah, that.
How did you turn terror into doing the bloody thing?
Yeah, because well, I mean this position is I mean you how many athletes are you overseeing in that position?
Yeah, so you got 450 athletes, and it's a mid-major college. So there was me and one assistant, and we got to turn it around. You know, we got to just
how many sportsmen at the time?
11
men's and women's for both, or
men's and women's. So yeah, men's and women's, and then obviously like baseball, softball was the creates the 11.
So not 11, but more like 22 or 21.
22. In 11 sports, right? And so that's your 450 athletes.
Wow.
And you know what, Tim? I've always felt like if you're absolutely terrified, it's probably the right job for you, you know, because it's going to be a really big leap. You know you're going to learn a lot. You know you're going to be stretched and challenged. And every role I've taken, I've been so scared going into it. So it's been a lot of fun to overcome that. But I think, Phil, to answer your question, you know, I think you just get thrown into it. You know, I don't think, you go for it despite being, you know, whatever fears you've got, and you just get to work.
Some of it too has to be, I mean, it was for me anyways, you don't know what you don't know. And that's a good thing when you're in that early stage. And then when you know it later, you're like, oh, good thing I didn't know that was coming. You just kind of take it. You just take it as it comes and you figure it out. And I think you make, you just learn from the mistakes as you go. And I think there is this idea that everybody that gets a position like that, or even above that, it's like that person must be experienced and polished and been through the ringer and have learned all the lumps. And it's not always the case. But I think the successful people in those roles have an ability to really recognize those moments when they're there as learning, not failure. And then you build on it. You just build your toolbox one little piece at a time every time you get an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's had to do this job for the first time, right?
Right.
You know, everybody had to make that leap. And I say over and over, but the easiest job in the world is being vice president. So when you're the assistant, you think you're a genius, man. You've got all the ideas, you've got opinion on everything, but none of them matter. Like, you don't have a say in anything, right? So you're the smartest guy on the planet, and then you got to go and do the job.
Right.
And you're like, oh, right. Yeah. It's not just what I saw the guy ahead of me doing. It's all this other stuff.
Yeah. 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 What is all the other stuff in a role like that? If you could kind of give us a little inside scoop on the things that you wouldn't assume. I think people see a job like that, like, oh, this is going to be great. At 9 a.m., I'm going to have women's soccer coming in. At 10 a.m., I'm going to have basketball teams coming in. It's just going to be booming in the weight room with music. And then everybody goes home at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of what it looks like, I think, from the outside. So you start your first team's probably at 5:30, 6 a.m. Your last team's probably clocking out around 8 p.m. right. You've got some space in the middle there where you might have a nap under your desk, but
right.
And a Snickers.
You've also got a program for those 20 teams.
Right.
Right. And so there's a huge amount of administrative side to it, which just comes with the job. But then it's scheduling and logistics. Okay. When do you get 22 teams into the weight room around their individual schedules? Right. And so that side of it, when that lands in your lap, you're like, oh man, like this is a lot.
Right.
And like your job with the schedule is to have everybody not too pissed off at you, right? Because everyone's going to be pissed off, but like, as long as you're not getting yelled at, you're probably okay.
Right. That's good. Yeah. I like that. And then on top of that, though, I have to imagine even kind of the micro side of that, like within a session, if you were to have a full team of 20 plus athletes walk in, I don't think that people, if you've never had to run a weight room like that, realize the coordination and organization that it takes to and logistics of how it what it takes to get a session, an hour long, 75 minute long session with that many athletes to run smoothly and safely. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly on the logistics side, because not only do you have 30 to 40 athletes coming in with a team, they also overlap by half an hour.
Right.
Right. So how do you make that work? So it you've got to design your programs with a flow where one group comes in and uses one area. As they're finishing up and move out of that area, the next group come in, and they just keep that cycle going all day. So you might have 60 athletes in the weight room, and then you've got to coach them all, right? And that was sort of what I tried to do, was take those learnings from my own strength conditioning background, from Maury and the rehab side of things, and from P3 on the individualization side. And we really tried to apply that at scale for those athletes, but crafting it around those weight room logistics, the volume of athletes, the time you've got for programming, you know, that's the sort of orchestration that you don't see behind the scenes on even how you set up the weight room. All right. And do you have the spaces designated for different areas and the space for people to move in and out? And that's before you've left the weight room to go and do conditioning on the field, right? So
right.
There's all these different, like, and then how do you staff that and make sure there's always someone in the weight room? And
that's such a
lot of moving parts.
That's such a multidisciplinary thing, right? Like a friend of mine, well, actually my first boss that ended up buying out a company that builds passive houses, you know, they're like wicked, the highest standard of house build there is from an environmental standpoint. And they talk a lot about people flow within residences, right? Within the home, and you don't want, you know, don't want a hiccup, or even a chef, like you hear maybe a Gordon Ramsay or someone like that talk about the setup of their professional kitchen, because whether they're making biscuits or soup or pick anything that a Gordon Ramsay might make you, and he isn't shouting at people and reaming them out. But I'm saying there's a multidisciplinary, kind of like the Fergus Connolly thing we talked about offline recently, where you've got to think about this almost like an architect would in a house, or a Gordon Ramsay, like an executive level chef would think about things just from a people flow standpoint.
Right.
Yeah, no question. There's no question. And that's where I think as a strength coach, certainly at the college level, you do have to be so multifaceted. Because that's not even then touching on the communication side of things. So even on the athlete front, you've got new incoming freshmen who that, you know, they're living away from home for the first time. So how are you communicating with them?
And maybe 5,000 miles away like us, right?
Exactly right. So you've got freshmen through seniors and maybe some graduate students. So you've got different levels of communication there. And then you've got a figure out how you're going to fight for resources with administration and have a good relationship with administration there. And then probably the hardest part is that you've also got 22 head coaches to deal with. Right. And so,
and their assistants and interns and all of that.
And everyone else. Yeah. So then everybody thinks that their sport is the most important one. And to them it is, right. To the participants of the sport, it doesn't matter if you're golf or men's basketball, right. That's the most important thing for you. So they're having those same fights that you are for time in the weight room, for attention from the staff, for resources from administration. So you've got to learn how to work all of those channels and communicate with now each team's got an athletic trainer and you've got 450 kids, you know, and so who's injured, what's wrong with them? What do you have to modify now? Again, because that default of just, okay, well then go get on the elliptical would be really nice when you've got 60 kids in the weight room.
Yeah. Right? So,
but if you're really thinking about it and you've got to make those changes, you know, it's just so much to manage and you've got to be so sharp and thinking on your feet and, you know, not married to your process and your dogma, right? You can't be stuck in it because everything's just constantly evolving and changing in that environment.
Right, right. So I picture there's a timeline within this where you start to feel like, okay, you're just, you're headed down the highway and you're barely seeing the trees and the exit signs, but all of a sudden the road becomes clear and you start to be able to see everything a little bit more clearly. You get your feet under you. But then what's the timeline where the Brooklyn Nets gig comes into play? And I guess the question I have from that is, were there things that you didn't even know you were taking the steps for, or phone calls you were having, networking decisions you were making that were helping you to have something like that come about? What was that like?
Yeah, and again, looking back on my career, there's a timing piece, but there's also like a making the time and finding the resources to network.
Right.
Right.
And yeah. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So like with the USA rugby thing, I didn't know anything was going to come from that. I'd had a couple of phone calls and then got an email from the strength coach that, hey, we're going to be in Ohio. You know, can you come up and present? And I was just starting my PhD and we were just broke, like flat right. broke. Right. It's tough. And so we found the money for a plane ticket up to Ohio for me to go and present, not knowing what was going to come from it. And it was a couple months after that when they called and said, hey, we got this role opening up. Right. So it's going, getting in front of people.
Right.
Networking, you know, having the social skills to be able to effectively network and get in a pretty short amount of time, get across your goals, but also sort of your personality and that you're going to be a guy people would want to work with.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, that sort of came out of him moving to work for Maury, going down and seeking out Marcus, meeting him, and carried on doing that while I was at UCSB. You know, we were closed one day a week in the weight room. And so that day I'd go down to P3. And particularly when he'd have some of his tough NBA guys coming in, he'd bring me down to work with them. And D Will was one of those guys.
Wow.
And so D Will and I, you know, had a great relationship. I'd head down to San Diego on the weekends to work with him when he was in town in the off season.
Another rough part of the world, San Diego. Terrible down there.
It was tough, but you know, it was a sacrifice I was willing to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we joke and you joke, but it's like you're putting in 5 a.m. probably have to open up the weight room at 4:45, 4:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. and then clean up until 9 p.m. all week long. And then you're spending your off day. Yes, it's a great, rich environment at P3 for you to learn in, but it's still, that's your one day to catch your breath. And you're in there still in the lab, just soaking things in. And then you're going on weekends to San Diego to, again, still continue to hone your craft. So it's great environments geographically you were in to do them, but still there was sacrifice that was going on.
And while married. So there's
we'll get to that part.
Yeah,
she's
seen you once in the last 22 years, in fairness. Yeah.
That's why we've stayed married so long.
That's the secret.
Yeah,
it's limited exposure. Yeah, that's a fair point, mate. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I think is the important piece as you're building your career is you've got to be in front of people. You've got to show that work ethic. You've got to leverage every resource that's around you, because if you've got the humility to and the awareness to recognize what your gaps are and what you don't know, when you go into that environment, your ability to go and see something new and see how it will incorporate back into your system, take the bits you really like, and you're building your system out of the parts of others that you really enjoy, whilst putting in that work, right? And making sure that you're getting in front of people. And that was actually the season that the NBA went into the lockout. So Darren went over to Turkey, played over there at Besiktas.
Wow.
So it was, we got his programming sorted over there and helped him out there. And then, lockout ended and, I'd had some contact with Billy King, who was the GM at the time, just through Darren. And he came out to San Diego one time when I was down there. And I just called him at one point, emailed him maybe, and just said, hey, look, I'd love some advice. I'd love to be an NBA strength coach one day. And you know, you're the guy who does the hiring. You know, what do I need to do? What do you need to see from someone before you hire them? And he just said, well, we're actually looking for a strength coach coming out of the lockout. And, you know, Darren really likes you. So we're thinking about bringing you in.
No way.
It's one of those moments you're like, wait, sorry, what?
Right. Oh yeah. My gosh.
Yeah.
Well, before you go on, I mean, that's so powerful how you took the initiative though of asking that question, right? Mm-hmm. You pitched it to him like, hey, you know, give me your thoughts. Like, what would it take for me to crack into this level? It's something of interest to me. And you started that conversation. Mm-hmm. Let's just say they weren't in the hiring process and targeting you without you even knowing it. At least mm-hmm. then you plant this seed with him who, you know, then who knows, he gives you a nugget of information and you go yeah. use it, or it's in the back of his mind that becomes the front of his mind someday. I think this is just to kind of reframe the context of it all, is you're working with an individual on the team. And then of course there's going to be some overlap with a GM who's got his pulse on what's going on. And so it's about back and forth about, hey, how's it going with Darren and all that stuff. Like right. there's a development of a trust and somebody that you respect, and from his end, the GM's end, starting to recognize, hey, every time I hop on the phone, it's super enjoyable to be on the phone with this person. He's professional. He's knowledgeable in his space. Darren seems to like him. I mean, those things all start to add up, even if they're just in little informal passing, sometimes even in a text, like how quickly are you responding to text? Wow, this guy's really on it, you know? And, mm-hmm. and I think those things can add up without people realizing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, people often say it's like a bad thing. Like, oh, wait, you know, he was in with D-Well, you know, and so he got the job. Well, that is true. But then I also had to show up and do the job.
That's right.
That's the big thing is, like, I think we all got into these roles because we had a connection with somebody. Right? Everybody gets to that level because like you said, they're making a decision that's going to impact, you know, a pretty expensive roster. Right. Yeah. And so you're going to need to trust that person. But, you know, I was told you get the job with who you know, you keep it with what you know. And so I think that's it's such an important thing to remember, showing up and actually then executing what you said you were going to. You know, I think, like you said, that building a level of trust, showing that you're responsive, showing that you're professional, you know, these are all such important factors in getting these roles.
No doubt.
Talk to us a little bit about the thing that excited you most about this transition into the NBA, and maybe the thing that conversely terrified you the most.
I mean, exciting is, I mean, it's the NBA, right? It's the show. And speaking of like things that you're glad you didn't know coming in, you know, I think that's also been a hallmark of my career. You know, I didn't grow up with the NBA. And I hadn't watched a ton of basketball before I got the UCSB job. That's where I really fell in love with the sport and the athletes. And, and similarly, like then seeing some of the NBA guys with their athleticism. I think what's exciting about the role is the resources of the organization combined with the athleticism of the athletes that are playing there. And it's you get to really imagine what could be possible if you weren't having a fight and fight and fight for resources and really scrap every day. And so you start to imagine what's possible if we could get the nutrition where it needs to be and get the, you know, the best training equipment and, you know, have all this time with them. And then you move from 450 athletes to 18, right? So, you know, all of this, I think, is just, it allows you to basically, you take each team that you had, and that becomes an individual. So all that focus gets to pour into the individual. So it's a tremendously exciting environment.
Yeah. In terms of, as you mentioned, I mean, face value, when you say something like, well, we go from 450 to 18, there's sort of maybe a notion that things get easier in that sense, but not always, because the environment's very different. Can you talk about some of the tricky parts of walking into an NBA weight room, what mm-hmm. that looks like. Yeah, the number's a lot less, 18 versus 450, but there's things that you don't have to deal with at UCSB that you've got to be on top of and then figure out how to tiptoe with and dance with with the Brooklyn Nets that you didn't at UCSB.
Yeah, man, it's a wake-up call. For real, like it's so easy from the outside to be critical of people who have roles in these organizations,
right?
But you have no idea what they're dealing with on the inside, no idea, you know. And if I had that job, I'd do this, and this, and this guy wouldn't be overweight. Yeah, he would.
Yeah, right. Good luck.
Yeah. So I think that's the thing. Like when you're dealing with sort of 18-year-old kids, you know, at a mid-major college. Weight room opens at 5. That's when you're in the weight room. That's it. No conversation. And you go down to a place like P3 and you've got the one athlete from each team who wants to train. And you think that's what the NBA is like, right? Man, these guys just want to get after it. And they're super explosive and this and that and the other. Well, we forget that athletes aren't exercise science students. They're not nutrition majors. They like playing basketball. And all the other stuff is actually really hard for them, right? Like, as somebody who's 7'2", your femur's as tall as I am,
right?
So I'm built for the weight room. I'm love it. 5'9". I'm tell killing the, it in the spot rack.
Tell the story, or if you can show it on video, if you could even pull it up, if I let you share your screen for the video portion of this telecast for people that are watching on video. Do you have that Lopez shoe? And your forearm?
I do some. I'll have to dig it up.
Yeah. Or can you describe what I'm talking about to us? Something you showed me offline a couple of weeks ago. And TD will get a giggle, but he knows exactly because we're talking like a Julius Randle shoe, but in this case, Mr. Lopez.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, you take Brooke, who was 7'1", 7'2", around a size 22 to 24 foot, and You can't picture how difficult it is for somebody with a femur that long to sit, to squat down, right? And the forces involved in somebody doing a squat, it's hard, and they're going to be so sore when they're doing it. And so you think they might be lazy. Like, these guys work so hard on the court.
Yeah.
But certainly then, you know, it wasn't as big a thing coming into the league. Guys weren't in these programs that some of them are now, where they're working out and they're doing all this stuff coming into the NBA. And so really you're having some guys for the first time, you're now having to negotiate with every guy to get them in the weight room.
Yeah.
So every lift's a negotiation every day. And so, you know, you'll have some guys that'll come in and they'll do it, two or three. Some guys will come in, they'll look at the board. I ain't doing that.
Right.
I bet you've never heard that, TD, right? At the Lakers or in the G League. Never.
Well, no, not since I left there.
Yeah.
But your point being, Jez, that not everyone is D Will, or in TD's case, not everyone is Kobe Bryant in terms of Kobe calling TD at 3 a.m. while you're in Milwaukee and saying, I can't sleep, let's go hit it. And then you come down and he's already half an hour into playing a sonata on the grand piano in the ballroom kind of deal.
Not everyone's
built like that.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, that's what separates him, right? And so you get those great players. But then so I always said, you've got those people, the top tier, who they knew they were going to be in the NBA. That was guaranteed. What were they going to achieve when they got there? That's your Kobe's, your KG's, your LeBron's, your Jordan's, those guys who have just got it. Then you got sort of your next tier of guys who got there and they're so happy like to be there. They're good pros, right? So they're going to do their work. And then you've got the guys who sort of didn't expect to be there, do their work, went to get there, and then they're just happy to be there, right? And if they're going to wave a towel at the end of the bench, you know, whatever it is. But then it's funny, that guy, they sign their contracts and then they disappear.
Right.
So like the art of sort of dealing with those different thirds of the roster.
Yeah.
Of, okay, you got the guy who comes, I'm not doing that. Okay, well, what do you want to do? Some of the guys will be like, no, I'll do it. Like, shit. Okay. Some of the guys, all right, what if we change this for this and this for this? Okay, good. And then you got to go around and find those other guys, where are they hiding, and pull them out of the woodwork, right? And,
yep.
And it is navigating, okay, well, the coach wants to find them if they're not lifting. Okay, well, now you're the one that's got to tell them that.
Right.
Right. And so now how do you keep a positive relationship with guys that you've got to find? And these are all very individual relationships throughout the team. And you can get some really close relationships. But then you can get some where they can get a little contentious, because you got to have them in the weight room, right?
Right.
Certain coaches want them lifting, certain coaches don't. But, you know, there's all those different layers. And then, so then the other thing is like the politics within the organization, right? And who holds the power, and where are the sort of the bottlenecks of communication, and it's navigating all of that. It's all the communication you had in college, but just the stakes are just so much higher.
Yes.
And people like have spent years sort of entrenching and building their influence within the organization, and man, they're not going to relinquish it, you know, easily.
No, that's so true. And kind of that politics side and the different egos side is so tricky. Whether you're talking about internally within the organization, you're talking about people that are working for the player and they want to have their say, or they have a point of view, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. It's just, there's so many different things to take into account there that are way beyond, are we pairing trap bar deadlift with box jump and how many sets and reps, and not to mention the minutes they played last night. Like you said, the injuries that came in off of yesterday's hard practice that they didn't realize were there until they woke up that morning, and you had a lift plan for them, all that stuff. So there's so many pieces. I think I wrote down a couple of things there as you talked about how do you, and if I were picturing a entry level strength coach to be taking a position at any level, whether we're in a new MBA job or a college job, a high school job, anything. How do you sort of stay true to yourself, get enough of what you need to get to be the professional that you are and the skill set that's being asked of you to be flexing across that roster? And I think these three things I wrote down were things that I learned the hard way. I mean, that's basically, but number one, I think it's really important not to take it personally. Cause like you said, at that NBA level there, it's one thing for there to be some policy that they sign in their player handbook or whatever in their contract that says you're going to be fined if you don't show up. But then when you, as the strength coach, sit there, and it's not as easy as just saying, and actually Ramsey Nijem talked about this, is the one time he had to find somebody, and the pluses and minuses of that whole ordeal. It's not as easy as just saying like, well, yep, you owe me this, and then think that they're going to whistle their way home and come in the next day and be happy to be there. Right. There's a whole relationship side. So I think you have to do this dance of saying like, yeah, technically according to what they signed, I could find them right now, but this isn't the right moment to do it. I got to figure this out. Let's have a conversation first. I'm not going to take this personally. There's a lot of aspects that went into this person not deciding to come in when I told him I needed to be in the weight room. The other thing is just time. Like if you can repeatedly show up and be consistent with how you are delivering your skill, but also your personality, people start to get to know you and they give you a little bit more leeway. They respect you a little more. They understand you better. They say, you know what? I'm not going to give Jeremy or Tim a hard time today. Let me get in there and get him that lift. I know he wants it more than I do, but whatever, I got to do it. You know, even if that's what's happening, at least then they're meeting you somewhere in the middle. And then being yourself. I mean, I think it's so easy to have the pressure that you mentioned in a big, you've got your GM coming down after who lifted today. You know, I saw so-and-so, they left early. Did they lift in the morning? going? I didn't see him. What's going on here? And you know the whole story, but you're not really and it's like there's a lot of pressure. And so I think it's easy to kind of fall out. If you're a rah-rah strength coach, fine, be that. If you're not, be careful of sliding into that, thinking that that's what it takes. It really just takes time, and then you being yourself in that process to be able to kind of develop the rapport. And I think that's the art of the whole profession, right? The science is the science. This is fun stuff. We can all talk about, you know, sets, reps and dosages and everything like that, exercise variations that are fun to think about and that kind of stuff. But yeah, those are the things that came to mind. That's, I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely the art. It's these are the things I think you learn on the fly, but you've got to bring a certain amount of it with you. You know, I think earning that trust is such a huge piece. And if you walk in day one and you're finding guys, man, you're like, that's going to be a tough year for you. I think, like you said, you don't know what other influences are at play. You don't know else is going on in somebody's life. Maybe the kid was sick and they had to leave. And then you roll up the next day and you find them, like it's just a bad look. So I think really understanding what's going on with the guys, reading the room, you know, like, we're off the back of 5 losses. This might not be the time to start finding guys, right? Let's keep morale up a little bit. And I think leveraging the people you do have a good relationship with to sort of bring some of those other guys around and using the social influence of your roster. Even if, you know, in a similar way, my conversation with the GM, I think sitting down with a senior guy and be like, hey, how can I get to this guy?
Yeah.
Right. And asking them in a way that you're asking for advice. And then sometimes they'll go around the other way and actually they'll have a word with the guy as well. Like, hey, you got to put in your time in here.
So that's such a good point.
Yeah. Who did you have other than D Will that you look to for that kind of veteran, the thing you would expect to hear about a Udonis Haslam in Miami, right? Or anyone else that's knocking on the door of 2 decades in the league and being, you know, an in quotes pros pro. Who are you guys and how did they help with that kind of end run around thing sometimes?
Yeah, Darren was great right off the bat. You know, I think because, you know, he was sort of the star in Brooklyn. So having him doing the right thing was really good, because then what are the other guys going to do? We're the New Jersey Nets still at that point, and you know, we weren't a very good team. So having someone like Darren come in, you know, the guys see him doing his thing and they followed. And then was super fortunate after that to have KG. You know, Kevin was just a machine. Just like every day, his routine was the same. He'd come in and he'd eat, he'd get his treatment, he'd come and lift. I mean, he was in the weight room by 7:30 in the morning. You know, beat me there some days, and I'd hear about that. then he'd do that. Then he'd watch his own film. Then he'd go get his own shots up. He'd do team film. Then he'd practice. Whether you told him he had to rest or not, he was practicing. And so having a guy like that, again, elite star. He's been in the league longer than our rookies have been alive. And so you sit down with him like, man, how do I get this young fella? Right. How do I get to him? And so he wasn't shy about going and getting the young fella, but he'd also, you know, give me some great advice on how to get them. How do you get the buy-in, you know? And so, so fortunate to work with Kev for 2 years.
So that's so cool.
It's sounding like he would not be jamming with the current take on in quotes load management as the casual fan knows it, which is, oh, well, so-and-so has to rest tonight. And it obviously is viewed a lot differently in other sports. Like you mentioned, anything coming out of the Australian Institute of Sport, squad rotation in rugby, pro soccer in England, like Premier League. Manchester City showed why having 20, you know, whatever, full internationals in your squad. They basically won the Premier League title because of depth of squad, right? It wasn't just Arsenal choked, which they kind of did, but they had a couple of key injuries. But you've got to have depth of squad. Helps to have some oil money, and there is not parity, you know, there's no luxury tax, but it's a different approach to load management, and squad rotation has been a term that we're familiar with coming from Europe a lot longer than in quotes load management and its current guys. But how would KG have reacted to... I'm guessing maybe, Tim, there's some parallels with Kobe here or MJ or...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one day I hit his shoes so he couldn't practice. So he went out there in his socks.
So he went out in his socks.
Yeah. Like, you know, and, or if we'd make him miss a drill, he'd shadow the drill at the side on his own. Like, he's going up for rebounds. He's, like, throwing elbows, like, on his own at the side and run, right, sprinting back on D, you know. And so, like, I mean, the guy played the fifth most minutes in NBA history. And I think that, you know, yeah, he had some injuries and he was breaking down a little bit there at the end. But again, he did the work. Like, and that's sort of what I think about load management too. I hate it in its current form, you know, in that once we start measuring something, suddenly we think we got to reduce it. And so it's like, well, whatever happened to working really hard and getting in great shape? Right. And I think that's what we're losing right now, is thinking that we got to protect people from load. We don't have to prepare them for it. And much like in our rehab, where we got to incrementally increase the load to the demands, we just got to know the demands of the game and prepare people where it's when we spike them above their load that they're conditioned for that we start seeing injuries. And I'm not saying we never have to rest guys, but our injury prevention program's there so they don't miss games. And what we're seeing now is injury prevention programs that are causing guys to miss games. Right?
Because of reducing the work.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say, okay, well, this guy can only play 60 games. Well, then he might as well get hurt.
you're actually creating the spikes.
Yeah. Yeah. You're creating the spikes, but also defeating the object.
Right.
Right. We don't want them to get hurt so they don't miss games.
Right. Right. Like,
so now we're telling them to miss the game. So it's like, well, yeah, so I don't really get that. But I think if we create a situation where they've got a high chronic load, you know, along with all of the other factors, you know, that's one small part of it. But if they're strong enough, if they're explosive, if the nutrition's right, and we create a really strong and robust athlete that is resilient to the back-to-backs, to the travel schedule, then as we go into playoffs, we can really see them, you know, start to be resilient, be able to play at that level throughout the playoffs, versus going from rest, where we took out shoot around and then we started taking out practice and now we're missing games. So our load's coming this way and then boom, go play at the highest level you can possibly play at every night for the next month.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think you see this with different organizations, and it is sort of, that's one of the tricky parts. This isn't all, that's what makes this topic so much like catching water, is because there are, every organization has a different approach to kind of how mm-hmm. they define or implement load management and deal with it. And so, but you do see some organizations where it's like, okay, playoffs are coming. We've got a high seed. We're going to start to really mm-hmm. reduce guys' minutes going into playoffs. And then it's like, oh, playoffs are here. You're on. And it's, you know, 40 minutes a game. And we expect you to be at this new intensity, because that's, whether people like to hear it or not, the intensity of the games increases drastically mm-hmm. from regular season to the playoffs, and that's just the reality. So I think that's a big mistake that organizations mm-hmm. from time to time make, and it's not, I mean, rarely is that, I would almost say never is that the strength coach making the decision.
Yeah, right.
You know, but yeah, you know, whether it's from upstairs, it's from head coach and upstairs talking together, or wherever it's from, you know, that idea on paper is like, oh yeah, we're going to save our bullets for mm-hmm. the playoffs. And it's physiologically, you know, musculoskeletally, that's not how it works. Mm-hmm. And you create this drastic reduction in their, as you said, chronic workload, the work that their body is used to being at. And then suddenly that workload is drastically spiked when the mm-hmm. when the first game of the playoffs starts. And I think you see some of that bearing its ugly head. I think the other error that people make in the assumption from afar of what's going on is that more miles on a body means it's going to break down, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. not true if the preparation right. is right for it. And also there's factors we can't always control, like injury history and stuff like that. Right. But it doesn't necessarily work that way. It's why our profession is amazing, in my opinion, and I'm sure in yours too, is because we do have an impact. And this is where I'm going with this, is I'm curious, where do you feel, because of all that, because it's rarely just on the strength coach to say, like, yes, rest them or not, or even have any say in that, really, where do you feel like the strength and conditioning coach, let's go right into the NBA and be very specific to that environment, has the biggest ability to impact what we can? What can we control?
Mm-hmm. We can control things like, number one, the nutrition. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the biggest factors in recovery. Mm-hmm. You know, making sure that nutrition's really good. I know that was a big focus for you.
Sure.
Out there in LA. We can control, are the guys prepared for the demands, right? So strength-wise, NBA right. guy jumps up, comes down from dunking the ball, they're going to land with 10 times their body weight, right? Is their system ready to take that, and is it ready to take it over and over and over again throughout the year? So I think these are huge areas that we can control. Making sure that our guys who maybe we are seeing a decline in their minutes for tactical reasons, for whatever, making sure they're getting a little extra. Are we maintaining their load, but not often those guys will get absolutely killed the next day by the assistants.
Right.
Where they're actually now doing more than the guys who are playing. So are we giving them enough?
Yeah.
Enough is as good as a feast, as they say. So we get enough and we keep them steady. And then we influence where we can, right? We give our expert advice to the coach. You know, that's on us to create a relationship with the coach and the general manager where we're having influence, we're showing them the data. And this is where, again, you speak about don't take it personally. If you say, and this is something that a mistake that I made in my career, I took things quite personally early on, back when I knew everything. And
likewise,
you give people advice on, you know, we should travel at this time, we should rest here and not rest here, and then they do the exact opposite. I think it's really important to understand that you're giving them one piece of information that's adding to the 100 other pieces of information that you know nothing about that are all feeding into that one decision. So, and that's the empathy you got to have for the people above you, is that yours isn't the only bit of information they have, right? They're not telling you about all the others, but they're making a decision based on, you know, we're going to take the red eye because every one of the players has come to the GM and said, I got to get home for this, this, and this. We've been on the road for 2 weeks, right? The business side of things, we got appearances we got to do, you know, there's all these other competing agendas that your job is to be credible, to have really good information, be scientifically sound, present that, and it will have the impact that it's going to have.
No,
but it's not your decision at the end of the day.
So perfectly said. What are the data points that you often like to, if you were in an NBA weight room right now, or when you were there, what are the data points that you would collect and use to help you to, like you said, just filter information upward to those who want to take it and do what they can and want to? We hear this term athlete monitoring. What are the things mm-hmm. that you like to look at?
Yeah. So we would have various, screening and monitoring processes going on. So a number of things. So soft tissue, everybody sort of does their screening in camp, but how do we take that and turn it into monitoring throughout the year?
Right.
And so various factors, you know, whether it's Achilles and we're doing a hop on the force plate, looking at ground contact times, are they staying consistent throughout the year? So if you measure them every couple of weeks and you start seeing a guy trending in the wrong direction, that's, you take the risk factor that you're monitoring, whatever it is, for whatever injury. And if a guy deviates from their norm in a significant manner, what's your intervention from that?
Mm.
So like I said, it might be a hop, but if you know, okay, if he, his ground contact time changes by one standard deviation, he's got an appointment in the, with the PT. Maybe he is resting. Maybe we increase his collagen intake before practices. You know, what are the factors that we can influence in that injury risk factor that aren't stop playing basketball?
Right.
You know, because ultimately, these are basketball clubs. They're not sports science clubs.
Right.
And so, so we need to, we are there to support basketball and not the other way around.
Yeah. So, and you mentioned collagen from the nutrition side, but if we're talking tendons in your example, again, back to your bigger point, it's oftentimes don't do less, do more. We've got to load those tendons that might be showing signs of any degradation or irritation or pathology on that front. Is that,
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So then they're on their, combined with their nutrition protocol, they're also then onto their tendon protocol.
Yeah.
You know, so it's your isometrics and all these things in conjunction with what your sports medicine staff are doing.
Yeah.
Maybe it is rest on the court. Maybe they don't do certain drills in practice that day in service of, because they're going to play the next day.
Right.
Right. And right. So that's the emphasis. And I think, making sure, because the coaches have started viewing sports science, I think, because we've had a tendency to be like, to shut them down. Coaches have started sort of defending their position a little bit as well. It can become quite contentious. So I think so long as your coach knows that you're trying to have guys ready for games, they'll give a little bit more on practice. But it's not a tool you can use every day. You can't every day go and ask to shut a guy down. I think we got to pull the levers we've got off the court first before we start interfering with practice. Because that's the other thing that you don't know what's going on. When I went to soccer in my last job, it was the first time being in the coaches' meetings every day, start to finish. And the planning practice, man, the drills, do I have enough guys for this drill? Right? You take a guy out, you change the whole practice that they've just spent all morning planning, right?
That's so true.
So it's even things like that, things that it really dawned on me then. And that's towards the back end of my career in sport, where it's like, oh man, yeah, this, it's really impactful on how a coach plans practice if you're going to pull these guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jeremy, what about something like RPE? It's not sexy. It's not technology based, but ratings of perceived exertion score. What's your stance there in terms of the value of it, the challenges using a scale like that, and how it's woven into other data points around it?
You know, I really like it. And it goes back to, you know, if you want to know how a guy feels, you should probably ask him.
Right.
You know, we collect all this data and like, we start assuming how they feel because we're looking at these numbers. Go ask him. He'll probably tell you.
Yeah. Amazing.
So I think it's critical because guys are really sensitive to how hard something was.
Yeah.
So long as they understand the concept, so long as you've got a good solid relationship, you're always going to get the guys that are a 7 every day.
Right.
You know, it's the guys that, you know, are honest with you, like really just go off their scores. How hard was practice? This was a 10. You can believe that guy.
Right.
Right.
Or if the guy does
move from a 7.
Or AKG, yeah. It's a joke. It was a 1. Give me more, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No question. So I think it's critical. And look, not everyone has the luxury of having a GPS system, you know, an accelerometry system. So we were using things like RP before this stuff was around to give us a number on load. And so I think, you know, the RPE times minutes equation, you know, it's consistent, it's reliable. If you don't have any equipment to monitor, you know, directly, then do that.
Jez, no doubt. I know you have a pretty strong opinion on sleep tracking / sleep monitoring as well. And maybe this plays into a similar thing. If you want to know how well rested a guy is, ask him, how do you feel today? Yeah. Are you tired? You feeling pretty good? Because we know Andy Galpin and I, in the research we did for Unplugged and Brian McKenzie too, you can get a 99 on your Whoop band, your Aura ring, and this isn't the call out, you know, well, let's mention all of them, Polar, Garmin, whatever.
Yeah.
You could maybe, well, it would vary, right, because of the error rate on all these devices, but a guy might feel like crap, whereas he may get a 68 and he may feel amazing and be able to perform at his best. So there is a disparity there. But talk to us a little bit about sleep monitoring and give us the full on jazz both barrels with this.
Yeah, first of all, I think sleep's, it's the number one performance enhancer known to man. Right. And so I think we're doing our athletes a big disservice if we're not focusing on it. If you could put it in a pill, they would ban it tomorrow. So I think that that's the thing we've got to acknowledge here is sleep is absolutely critical. Sleep and nutrition underpin every facet of human performance. So the difficulty with monitoring sleep, first of all, there's no such thing as monitoring of sleep stages, certainly with a wearable. Like they're 70% accurate on a really good day, right? It's actually even really difficult to monitor sleep stages in a lab all hooked up, you know, in the sleep science labs.
Right.
So it's difficult to do there, but it's a marketing thing. Everybody did it. And so now everyone has to do it. Yeah. Right. These things are quite good at telling us when we're asleep and when we're awake. All right. And so that's, they'll put a pretty good buffer
sometimes, although not for daytime naps, based on the most recent stuff out of the Naval Research Center in San Diego, they whiff on that and there are a ton of false positives. So if you're using it for napping people, one, read that study, and two, beware.
Yeah, just these things are a guide. Again, we talked about one piece of information. One bit of information is, what did my Oura Ring say? The second piece is exactly what you said for what, how do I feel? Right? You can't rely on these like it's gospel. You've got to, over and over, you've got to be thinking about, okay, is this passing the sniff test? Right. This is giving me an idea. This is giving me a ballpark. It's showing me my habits, right? Are my behaviors allowing me to get the sleep that I need? You know, am I getting in bed to give myself an 8-hour sleep opportunity? But man, you start messing with people when you put these on them, especially like NBA. Like I use fatigue science. So I was such a believer in it. But what you find is, like, take the NBA schedule, right? You've been through it, Tim. You're tired all the time.
Yep.
Right? There aren't days when you feel great.
Right.
Right? And so you're on a back-to-back. You've flown from New York to New Orleans, right? You've got in at 3 a.m. You've got sleep monitors on. Whether you're wearing the sleep monitors or not, that game's getting played in New Orleans.
Exactly.
And it has been doing for decades, right? We've been playing that game. And this is just how guys feel playing that game. Now you're telling them you feel like shit and you're at 30% higher risk of injury.
Yeah, it's not only you feel like shit, and because they could have told you that, you put a number on how much shit they feel like.
Your HRV sucks, by the way. Yeah. So shame. Shame on you, KG.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're probably going to miss all your shots. Right. You know, and your hand-eye coordination is going to be terrible.
And you might die.
Yeah, you know, and so it's like, oh, wait, what?
Right, so right.
We had some guys that like Jay, I can't keep wearing this. Like, yeah. It's messing with me because I'm coming into the game. It's telling me I'm a 60 out of 100.
Yeah.
Like, I got to play. Like, what do I do?
So you're saying there's a mental component to this, Jez, as well as physical. Like it's predisposing them to have a negative self-limiting attitude going into practice or a game in some ways, in some cases.
Well, yeah, and it just messes with their confidence.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's such a critical thing for athletes to come in regardless, sort of feeling like they can still conquer the world because that's sort of where they live. And so I think how I would use it now differently is as an education tool. Like that this isn't like, don't worry about your score because the fix is more long term, right? The fix is more behavioral. The fix is as, can we change some of what we're doing with the schedule next year? Can we modify the flights? Can we cancel shoot around? Can we move the meeting later? So this is a study for us on how we create the environment for them to get sleep and be recovered versus I need you to know if you feel like shit right now. right? And so I think it's great for us. Maybe we do have some, maybe it's some extra caffeine. Maybe there's an extra warm up we can do for their nervous system. But outside of that, it's pretty challenging to see really how useful these tools are right now.
Is there a tendency, yeah, Jez, toward absolutism where it becomes like a biblical list of thou shalt nots, like thou shalt never drink alcohol when I play in the NBA, thou shalt never drink caffeine after noon, right? And we're talking to a guy here, TD, that used to travel. I have it on good authority from Ron Artest / Meadow World Peace that TD used to travel with his suitcase. Maybe there was a whole extra case, TD, by the end, with a French press and 5 pounds of beans and a grinder. So there was coffee culture, folks, before Jimmy Buckets and his whole thing.
No doubt.
A long time before. And Dame Lillard has spoken about this. You know, I think, was it Baxter Holmes, TD, that did kind of the definitive story on caffeine culture, right, in the NBA? Right. So, yeah, people go check that, because I'm pretty sure back with the glory days of ESPN, the mag, Baxter went to town on that thing. But, yeah, Jez, do you think that there's sometimes this almost like list of religious observances that will not fly in the realities of professional sport and the NBA around sleep and caffeine and this kind of thing?
Yeah, I lived there. that was very much me in my early career, even like getting to the Nets. You know, I think that's where my first couple of years in pro sport, you know, really took the edge off of some of my sort of more dogmatic approach to things, you know, and because the realities are just so, you know, opposed to what your dogmatic view of perfection is.
Sure.
I think it's so important to understand that you're going to have caffeine afternoon because you play, you know, at 8, 9 at night, right? You're still playing at midnight some nights, right? And so, right, yeah, you're probably going to have some caffeine, right? And we're not going to sleep great because we're going to land at 3 a.m. and the guys have got kids and they're going to be banging the door down at 6:30. Right. So there's just so much going on. Like, people forget that athletes are also humans, you know, first and foremost. They spend a fraction of that time actually playing their sport. So their life looks no different to anyone else who has kids or who has a wife or who has, you know, other competing demands. And so I think that we have to build performance around the human being, and around the realities of an 82 game schedule, around playoffs, around flights, right? And it's, I always said, like, pro sport was the best bad way of doing everything, right? It's we're not going to be perfect, so find a way to do it and just get it done.
That's, I love that saying. And I do think that there's a notion from an outsider's perspective that it's in a vacuum and everything must be, first of all, from one organization to the next, it's all the NBA. So it all has to be done. They all must be doing it all the right way. Mm-hmm. And whatever the best decision is or the best move is, they must be making that decision or making, right, that move or buying that piece of equipment, because why wouldn't they? And that's not how it works. I mean, it just, mm-hmm, is, you know, and so it's, there's a saying that my former boss, Gary Vee, used to say is, in the NBA, they'll swallow a stork and choke on a gnat. And it's like, you can't always figure out why things are being done a certain way. And sometimes it's because, well, we've always done it this way. Sometimes, mm-hmm, it's because we had a player who's very high profile who complained about it and we stopped doing that. And even though it would be better to do it this way, we chose not to. And there's just so many factors that, right, go in that make it off of the ideal, let alone just the roller coaster of the meat grinder of the schedule itself, even, mm-hmm, if you were able to make all these decisions in a perfect vacuum with just the best, you know, scientific decision behind it. This has been just fascinating, Jeremy, and I want to respect your time, and we have one famous final question we'll get to in a moment, but I'd love for you to kind of give us an idea of the mindset and the approach you took, because your journey has been just absolutely unique in the sense of elite rugby, elite soccer, elite level basketball, NHL hockey, so on and so forth. And college versus pro. I mean, you've gone, many people get into a track and they stay there. They go college, they stay college their whole career. They go pro, they stay in the pros their whole career. If they're going to get in that track from a environment standpoint, they usually stay with a sport for their whole career, that kind of thing. How did you have so much success going from different levels, different environments, different tracks, and different sports over your career? What was it that you took into those changing chapters of your career that allowed you to be successful in each one of them?
Yeah, I think like the diversity in my career is probably the strength of it, you know, because you've seen so many different scenarios that you're really not nervous about anything that could happen to a player. You've probably seen it happen, right? And you've probably fixed most issues that could possibly happen. So I think that you just get more reps, right, by seeing different environments. I think the approach I've always taken is that we're really fortunate in our side of sport in that we're agnostic to sport, and everyone who does what we do, sports medicine or strength conditioning or any of the other professions away from the sport itself, is that we deal with the human body. And so long as you can understand the energy systems, the biomechanics involved, you know, the different demands of the sport, we can train the human body to do that, right? If you're a big man coach in the NBA, you're not going to go be a goalie coach in the NHL,
right?
Like you've got a job, right? And that's your track. That's not the case for us. We shouldn't feel trapped and confined to one sport. We should be able to move between sports. I mean, it's just more interesting to me. Like my brain craves novelty. And so I think that movement for me was exciting. It was terrifying. It was, you know, it was fun and man, the learning curve just sort of never seemed to end. So that for me was my mindset, and it was more about what were the opportunities for me to take a step in my career, you know, and what were the environments that were going to allow me to execute my job in the best way I could?
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and it's really impressive. I mean, it's to me, it's that idea, your career path to this point and so much more to come, but has really defined that idea that we all hear, and sometimes it's overused, but of getting out of your comfort zone and how healthy that is for us and how exhilarating that can be if you choose to look at it that way. So bravo, sir, for that. Famous final question. This is the Basketball Strong podcast. You can answer this from your gut, your heart, your mind, all the above. Answer it technically, spiritually, however you see fit. But the question is, what does it mean to you to be basketball strong?
I think it means to me being resilient and being able to execute your role within the team whenever you're called upon, right? Because there'll be times when you're sitting for a string of games. There'll be times when you're starting for a few games, and it's, for me, it's consistency in your approach as you navigate those ups and downs, right? Everyone wants to work hard when you're up, but that guy who's in the weight room when you're down, because he knows he's going to get the call, right? It's a long season. You're going to be called upon. And I think the guys who can stay ready, stay resilient, stay robust, help their teammates, right, lift the team, I think that consistency is what makes guys career pros, you know, the guys that are in for 10 plus.
So good. Phil, lock it in the vault, baby.
Locked.
So, Jeremy, just, like I said, I mean, just a... listening and taking notes and kind of learning from everything that you've been through has just been absolutely pure gold for us. Where can people follow? Tell us what you're doing now. Where are you at now? What's the day to day? And where can people follow, tag in, and keep getting more great stuff from you?
Yeah. So getting more comfortable in that sort of public world. So LinkedIn and Instagram mainly, Jeremy yep. Bettel Coaching, Jeremy Bettel on LinkedIn. Yeah, right now I'm back here at working with Maury again. We're basically building a high performance system for general population. So wow. all those systems that we put in for pro athletes, we're doing here in Santa Barbara. We got all the technology, we've got physical therapy, we've got trainers, and so bringing that whole system to bear for people who want to go play pickleball at the weekend, right? And it's just been so much fun. And seeing the gains, you know, you go from getting these incremental gains with pros to like 75% improvements in these metrics, right? When you right. start applying these same systems to like your average human being, you know, so it's so much fun. And living here in Santa Barbara. So, just fantastic. Yeah.
So check out what they're doing at Variant. Jeremy, real quick, just tell us about that T3 model that you guys have got there. It's not P3. And I'm not enunciating well enough. It's T for Tommy.
So yes. So test, treat, train, essentially. Everybody comes in and gets evaluated on a three-tier system. So physical therapy exam, sort of at the skeletal level, segmentally, how's everything moving? Regionally, how are the joints moving and interacting together? Then we go out for a more kinetic evaluation. So either side of the joints, you know, what's the muscle balance, internal, external rotation, for example, hips, knees, trunk, ankles. And then we go over to more of a kinematic evaluation of their movement and how they producing force on the force plates, the 3D motion capture. And so we can then start really moving into, okay, is that movement dysfunction coming from a joint issue, right? Is that something that a PT needs to see? So that's the treat part, or is it coming from a neuromuscular where we actually need to train this?
Yeah.
And so it's always a combination. So combining the PT with the training, both collaborating on writing a program for that individual and then having them continuously go through that cycle of test, treat, train, where we can really sort of continually dial in on that individual. You know, it's so rewarding getting people out of pain and watching them go through that next sort of cycle of, okay, now I want to get back to improving my golf game, right? Now I want to get back to this. And you see people, you know, for me, this is a longevity clinic. You see people getting back to the activities that they love, and we're really getting them off the couch and helping genuinely impact their longevity.
Love it. Absolutely exciting stuff. Can't wait to have you back for part two and talk more about how that develops and what you're growing there. So yeah. Well done, sir. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Tim, Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed today's show, and we hope you did, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you listen to podcasts on. And so you never miss a weekly episode, be sure to subscribe and follow. You can find previous episodes on our show website. That's www.basketballstrongpodcast.com. For more basketball performance resources and nagging injury solutions, follow me on Instagram at TDAthletesEdge and follow Phil at Phil White Books. Until next week's episode, stay basketball strong.